You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
No, what?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, no, don't do that. If you shoot him, you'll just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Hello, you are listening to Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. Many thanks to Neil Whiteside for the past couple of hours of Too Good to Be Forgotten. But now, as the clock strikes noon, it's time for Bums on Seats, the fortnightly gaze, gawp and gander at the latest film screening in and around Cambridge. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me in the studio this afternoon are Emma Marchant.
Hi there.
Simon West.
Hello.
And new reviewer Yossi Osman.
Hello.
Today's show is all about men, 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 with three films that struggle to drift their male gaze away from the male. Ben Affleck might be a murderer in Gone Girl, David Fincher's grubby and pitch-black adaptation of Gillian Flynn's best-selling Page Turner. Robert Downey Jr. is an arrogant lawyer who must face up to some home truths in The Judge, whilst Brad Pitt's bark is worse than his bite in Fury, an unrelenting depiction of life in a tank command during the Second World War. As well as reviews, we also look forward to the 13th Cambridge African Film Festival, talking to its director, Estrella Sandra, about the huge wealth of films and experiences on offer between the 1st and 9th of November. And ahead of their free screenings in Cambridge next week, we have a short interview with the directors of the avant-garde films Crossing Point and The View from Our House. That's all to come, but we start the show in a perfect marriage.
Everyone told us and told us marriage is hard work. Not for me and Nick.
As you all know, my wife, Amy Elliott Dunn, disappeared 3 days ago. I had nothing to do with the disappearance of my wife. I have nothing to hide.
Has Amy got friends we can talk to?
No, not really.
You don't know if she has friends, you don't know what she does all day, and you don't know your wife's blood type.
Just being a good guy, so everybody can see him being a good guy.
Well, you really don't like him, do you?
All I'm trying to do is be nice to the people who are volunteering to help find Amy.
I will practice believing my husband loves me, but I could be wrong.
I'm hoping you can tell me what this means.
Want to solve Amy's treasure hunt?
You seen this girl around here?
Yeah, I remember her.
I know you. I saw you at the volunteer center.
I wanted to help.
What'd she want?
She wanted a gun.
We are all scared, but we are all here now.
I feel like something to be jettisoned if necessary. I feel like I could disappear.
Whilst he began his career in a wonderful fit of pique, after all he killed Newt, beheaded Gwyneth Paltrow and tried to blow up Starbucks, director David Fincher has settled into being a purveyor of the mildly transgressive blockbuster. After a remake of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo that was as beautiful as it was redundant, Fincher has once again looked to Pulp Fiction for inspiration, working with novelist Gillian Flynn to adapt her mega-hit novel, Gone Girl. In its first scenes, Gone Girl seems ill-suited to Fincher's misanthropic tendencies. Ben Affleck's charming designer Nick Dunn sweet-talks Rosamund Pike's perfect Amy, first into bed and then into marriage. Amy is a delight, successful in business and, as a childhood model for a series of best-selling books, a squeaky clean inspiration to millions. But when both lose their jobs, Amy has to scale herself down to Dunn's parochial hometown, playing the dutiful housewife whilst her husband runs a local bar with his sister. Then, one morning, she goes missing. There's signs of a struggle, a pool of blood ineffectually cleaned up and an incriminating diary found. A gathering of evidence at all points to Nick as his wife's murderer. Emma, Gone Girl opened some weeks ago, but it has dominated the film press ever since, with calls of misogyny levelled at David Fincher, though interestingly not quite so much at Gillian Flynn's screenplay. Does the film warrant such catcalls, or is it merely misunderstood pulp?
That's like an either-or, isn't it?
Yes, that's pretty much how the argument is split across the internet. You're either misogynist or you're not.
It's definitely not misogynistic. I never thought it was misogynistic. I'd read the book and I think that the film manages to become greater than the sum of its parts, actually. I think the combination of Gillian Flynn rewriting it for David Fincher direct turns the film into a greater piece of art, if you like, than I felt the book was. The book kind of, I read it quickly, it was, but it wasn't, it didn't kind of, it was, yeah, it's like you say, it's a bit of a trashy kind of beach read or whatever. The film, I think, is more than that. As a piece of filmmaking, you know, excellently technically, you know, David Fincher is renowned, obviously, for, you know, exacting take after take after take after take. But I think what was key in this was the casting. Ben Affleck has such a good undercurrent of kind of violent tension. Ever since I think he played O'Banion in Dazed and Confused, there is this side of Ben Affleck that is quite kind of butchly unpleasant underneath a kind of traditional white bread, you know, white bread male kind of persona, you know, all American guy. And Rosamund Pike is a revelation, I would say. And actually, the character of Amy is quite difficult, I think, to personify, because in some way she is almost just a cipher, really, I think, to keep the plot of the story going. And I think she does an excellent job in fleshing out what on the page wasn't maybe such an easy character to flesh out.
Perhaps it's the fact that Amy, who is crucial, she leads the film from the first shot to the last. It's her story, no matter the fact that we follow Nick Dunn for most of the running time, it's her story. But the fact that she can be seen as a cipher, as you just mentioned, is one of the reasons for the cause of misogyny, that she is simply this evil spider woman that leads the men astray.
It's not, is it? Like you say, it's as much like you said at the beginning. You said let's take a look at the perfect marriage, and obviously that is the whole point of this film. Look, on the surface you think perfect marriage, but underneath it all, it is just this seething mess of. It's just a seething mess of. The two of them are really quite unlikable. Nick is not a particularly likable character. There aren't that many characters that are likable in this film at all. That, you know, the detective, probably a female detective. In fact, yes, that's a good argument against misogyny. I think the female detective is one of, and also Margot Go, Nick's twin sister, are probably the two easiest characters to just say they are, you know, they seem to be good people, I think. Tyler Perry, who has a very good flashy turn as a kind of defence attorney, is also reprehensible in his own way, if you like. But I think so. There's definitely female characters in there that are powerfully good. Boo to misogyny. Boo to the internet. Boo.
Well, that said, none of those problems were an issue again. I've always remembered that. John Stewart at the Oscars. Sorry, Simon. I'll agree with Emma to an extent. It feels much more in line with Fincher's other work, all the way back to Alien 3, in the fact that he doesn't really like any of these characters particularly much, male or female. It seems part and part. Actually, it seems almost, in some respects, a sequel to The Social Network, yeah, in how he looks at modern society and the facade of it all.
I think it's completely overlooked by a lot of people how it is just completely skewing media, especially the 24-hour news media you get in America, where it's a story, everyone just goes all over it and picks at every little thing and expects everybody to be camera ready, and everything they do just gets picked over again and again by the media, and that's just since been overlooked. And that's a much bigger issue to be facing than the accusations of misogyny. I mean, you might as well, in Seven, just say it's about misandry because Kevin Spacey's a bad guy. It's just this film happens to be the bad person is a woman.
Well, they're all bad, but Nick, she's only slightly worse than Nick Dunn in many respects.
She seems to be a lot worse. Well, without actually giving too much away. But it is David Fincher. He's completely misanthropic. He doesn't like anybody in the film. Nobody in the film comes out. He doesn't like humanity, and that's why he's so dark and, you know, especially for a Hollywood director, he shows the dark side of mankind and everything like that. And that is why all his films are so watchable. And his performances are brilliant. I mean, you're saying, you know, Ben Affleck, I've always respected him as an actor. And again, here he's absolutely fantastic. I must admit, I was giggling at what Emma said earlier, because when she said about his dark undercurrent, I was more thinking about Mallrats, which I don't know how many of you have seen.
Yes.
And Rosalind Pike, she's gone from one of my favourite actresses to in smaller films she's been in recently, such as Hector and World's End, to someone who is very soon going to be absolutely massive again, because I'm sure she's going to be reaping the rewards of this film.
Probably by just being offered roles as duplicitous housewives. You know how Hollywood works. There isn't a well. Being brilliant in a film doesn't mean suddenly there's a wealth of equally brilliant, brilliantly written roles. You'll see, they come to you next. It's a complicated film for, I mean, it's running and running and running at the Arts Picture House, but it's a complicated film within blockbuster terms, in that there's dual narratives going on here. There's unreliable narrators on two sides, and there's a twist in the middle where it would normally be in the end, which changes the structure of the narrative. That there are two climaxes. It's a very fulfilling film on that level, but does Fincher keep it all together? It's a long film as well, 144 minutes. Does he keep it tight like in the thriller that he sort of designed it around?
I think he does. As someone who's read the book, I was a bit worried about how it would translate into a film because of this kind of narrative structure and the two voices that you get, and how, you know, you hear Amy's side through diary entries, and I just wasn't sure how it was all going to translate. But as a big fan of Fincher, only if there was one director who was really going to take that and do something well with it, it was going to be Fincher, and I think he's done it very well. I was sitting in a packed cinema, and I never got the sense that anybody around me was bored throughout all 144 minutes. I think he did it very well in terms of how he correlated the diary entries with Nick's side of the story. I thought the point where it changed from going from Nick's side to Amy's side about halfway through the film was handled very well. And I just thought it was a very good adaptation of the book. I don't know if that was partly because Gillian Flynn herself did the screenplay and that's how it translated so well, but I mean, I thought it was brilliant, and I thought he did a very good job.
Would you agree with Emma that I've not read the book, so I'm only going Emma's perception here, that it's it enriches the book, that it's a richer experience than the airport novel it's based on?
I really liked the book. I was transfixed by the book. It's a real page turner. So I was more worried that the film wouldn't be as riveting as the book. And I think the film did well. I mean, I can't say that I preferred it over the book personally, but I think the film did very well. And it's a very, for people that haven't read the book, I think, you know, you don't need to read the book. It was very well done.
I think I've been waiting for this for a while. Just really quickly, I think it's really important to say it's very faithful to the book. So if you want to level issues of misogyny at the film is incredibly faithful to the book. Like you said, Gillian Flynn wrote it. I read an interview with her where she had in a couple of scenes even thinking about David Fincher. There's a great scene where they end up in that kind of disused mall, the detectives, and it's visually quite good with the torches and they're in this kind of, it's a sign of, you know, the America's recession or whatever, that there's this mall that's just gone out of business. And Gillian Flynn said she wrote that, you know, specifically thinking about how well David Fincher could light that and make it look good. So they obviously work very closely together. So I think it's really important that is clear, that this is very, very faithful to the book.
It is. And, you know, the house, everything, it looked exactly how I imagined it to look when I read the book. So they, like you said, they must have worked really well together, because it was a very faithful adaptation.
What about the Gone Girls, the Cool Girl speech that's in the middle of the film, which is where the switcheroo happens in the middle, with Amy's long piece about having to pretend to be the cool girl, that even before the crime that the film's about, or the possible crime the film's about, she's had this mask on, and it's a mask that men have, through the ages of nowadays, sort of, she has to be perfect, she has to be this Hitchcockian perfection for her husband. I wasn't quite swayed by that. I know that Craig Skinner over at Film Divide, who's a notable voice on Twitter, said that it was infantile, especially on the grounds of the character who's speaking it is in her late 30s.
It didn't swing me in the book or the film. I find that whole thing problematic in the book and in the film.
But that's a big deal if it doesn't, because that's that's the axis on which the film revolves.
I mean, the character at that point is revealed. She has lived most of her life in the spotlight, living up to a perfect fictional character. So I think it is almost, you know, saying whether the character is, you know, damaged in some way, which is, you know, why she's doing the actions for everything. And again, that's reflecting the expectations you need to live under fame, and when you always have the cameras and the attention of
But I think you. I think he's so he's, I think he's, it is, he's saying much more about, he's trying to say much more. I think this is where the film falls down. You can level some, I don't think they stand up, but I can understand some of the calls of misogyny on the film when you seem to be trying to say something about a woman's place in the marriage more so than the man's place, or a woman's place in society. They don't listen to the police inspector at the end of the film. The whole room of male hospital attendants and other police inspectors don't listen to our police inspector who we've been following throughout the film. All the newscasters in the film, as awful as they are, they're all women. They're all playing an evil maternal role. This all swings on this cool girl speech, which if that doesn't work, the way Fincher's talking about sexism in home and in the workplace doesn't work.
I would like to make I want to make one thing clear. I think in my opinion and my reviews, you said is this misunderstood pulp? I think it is. I think it's quite a pulpy film. I don't think it's an incredible. When I said it's better, for me it enriched the book, but I thought I found the book pretty trashy. I'm not saying it wasn't a good read, but it wasn't like a great work of literature. I don't think this is a film that should be studied and considered. I think it's doing very well at the moment. I think that's down to some, like I say, cracking casting, and it's a good piece of entertainment. A little bit long, I always say that. I felt it could have benefited from maybe 15-20 minutes shaving. Personally speaking, I found the second up, but then I did know the story, so it's a different, you're obviously going in with a very different aspect from someone who is seeing this completely fresh, so maybe someone who's seeing it fresh wouldn't think it was too long. But I do think it is it's Friday night. It is a bit Friday night for the masses, I think, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, but that's part of the problem. If you're going to deliver that, and if you're going to deliver that with such a polished sheen as David Fincher does, and with an expectation that this could well be a masterpiece because he's made four of those, and I've got to count, am I right? one, two, three. He's made three of those.
Three and a half.
One shot in Benjamin Button and three whole films.
He's actually the opposite of Star Trek, if you notice.
Yeah.
The odd numbers are actually...
Anyway, I'm losing track.
I don't know what the masterpieces are.
The Seven, Fight Club, Zodiac.
Social Network.
Four masterpieces. All right. Within the confines of this studio, we believe. All right. It's not fun for the listeners. We should have done this before we went on air. If you're delivering that polished sheen without expectation, you have to be cleverer than this film perhaps is with its portrayal of the female characters. What about the character of the girlfriend, of Ben Affleck's girlfriend? That's... I'm intrigued by that character because she's played by somebody known for deliberately cast the student that Ben Affleck's having.
She's a model, isn't she?
She's a model, and she was in the Robin Thicke video being topless, and so she's known as that. And she
I do not watch a lot of Robin Thicke videos.
Well, it was famous last summer, but she was cast to have a negative impact on the audience as soon as she appeared.
And is that not maybe to give... Is that not sort of really then passing on that negative aspect to Nick? Because you're like, Nick is...
Or any of the male characters.
I thought watching it, because that annoyed me, because everybody within the film had acted as if they were not in a film until that character comes in. And then suddenly it's... And she acts like she's in a film. She's being stupid, this young girlfriend he's got. She's turning up at his door when she knows the police are watching him. She's forcing sex on him in a seductive way. She's acting like a silly female character in a silly generic thriller. And I was annoyed by that because I couldn't believe, why is Fincher doing this? He's smarter than this. But then I thought, well, maybe, and I don't know if this stands up, and it annoys me that it may not stand up, that he was goading the audience and that hate this character, hate this, here's a woman you can hate because she's so beautiful and she's so stupid within the confines of the film.
But do you not think that Nick comes across worse there? Because at the end of the day, he's the one that's having the affair, and I actually was more annoyed with him when that girl came along, and the fact that he's at his sister's house, he's being watched by the police.
Oh yes, he's equally culpable, yeah, but she acts in a sort of so generic way in a film that's trying to sidestep genre up until that point.
That could also be, though, that she is a relatively inexperienced actress, perhaps, like we've just said, and she's in amongst some real heavyweights there. Ben Affleck has got better and better and better with every film he's done. Rosamund Pike, as we've discussed, is so strong in this. Neil Patrick Harris is a very experienced actor, and so perhaps, she's known for being a model in a Robin Thicke video. Perhaps she hasn't had a lot of experience in film. So I'm saying maybe it could be partly a performance issue as much as a direction or writing.
And she was also playing a character who also was very, very inexperienced in life, unlike the other ones.
Yeah. That's exactly how the character is in the book as well.
Yeah, it's true. So she's a cliche. I mean, it is a cliche in the book. Yeah. And the whole thing is Nick has turned into this massive cliche that he, as a teacher or as a lecturer is having an affair with his, you know, with his student who's overcome by his seniority and intelligence. It's meant to be a clear. That's what I mean. I think, you know, it is kind of pulpy. It is. I don't know, I just think
it has to inspire. I don't mind it being based on pulp. Godfather's based on pulp. You could. I don't have this patronising attitude towards the book. I just think if you're going to end if you're going to have a 2 hour plus film that ends as bleakly as this film ends as bleakly as Seven, you've got to offer a little bit, perhaps more meat in your discussion. I'm not sure that this film does that. I think you can't. If you're going to do that, you can't just pass.
But I think it offers enough meat visually and in the performances to be able to stand up as a really solid piece.
I think it's one of these films that is, you know, it may not be as obvious first time round, but it is going to be studied, and you are going to see layers and layers and layers of context and commentary on society through this film, which I think a lot of them aren't necessarily obvious. But knowing David Fincher, it is going to be one of those films where you do, you know, you can come back 20 years later and say, oh, I never realised they're referencing this and this and this, and it is a film that everyone's going to keep going back to.
I'm not sure. I think because it's Fincher, we think that's going to happen. With Zodiac. I think it happens. It will happen less here.
As I mentioned earlier, I think part of the, for an example, is the fact that as far as I'm concerned, it was, you know, blatantly obvious all about the media. Yet most of the discussion I've seen hasn't been about that. So obviously there are multiple readings.
Well, I don't know. Fincher doesn't foreground that enough, I think, for that to be as important to the general audience as it obviously is to him. And it does start to slip into sort of obvious satire with some of that stuff. Sorry, Yossi.
Well, I was just saying, you know, I think you have to take it for what it is. It's a thriller. It's based on a very popular book, which is, you know, for the masses, it's just there to entertain. And when I watched it, I wasn't thinking about all these different arguments. I was thinking, is this going to be exciting? Is it going to keep me, you know, entertained for the whole 144 minutes? And it did. And it's a good thriller. And it kept everybody hooked throughout. I didn't think it needed shaving at all. I thought it was perfectly fine with its length. And, you know, I'm not really looking at it with a microscope. I just think it's very entertaining, and that's what it's supposed to be.
But if we don't look at things under a microscope, what's the point of the programme?
No, that's true, but for what it is...
You completely destroy our purpose for being.
For what it is, I think it's very well done.
Backing up Yossi's point, I mean, I went in with very high expectations because it is Fincher, and they were easily met. You know, ignoring all the discussion and everything like that, it comes down to the fact this is a very good film and very watchable and very entertaining.
Okay, we've got to wrap up or else we've got an hour on Gone Girl. That's no fun for anybody. Okay, Gone Girl opened last week and is found screening at all three Cambridge cinemas. It is a rare Certificate 18. I don't quite know why when Fury's only Certificate 15. Anyway, never mind. Okay, with the nights drawing in, we've got to move on. With the nights drawing in and winter in the air, it's only natural that cinema should fly south for the winter. In exactly a week's time, Cambridge plays host to the 13th African Film Festival, 9 days of movies showing at both the Arts Picture House and various venues around the city. Begun in May 2002 by a group of Cambridge graduate students and now partner with a mighty Film Africa, the festival's intention is to screen the best in contemporary African films, increase knowledge and awareness of African and black culture in the UK, and provide a counterbalance to the Western media stereotyping of Africa. Something we've sadly seen a good deal of in the past few months. This year's festival runs from the 1st to the 9th of November and offers 10 or so feature films, plus short films, workshops, talks, visiting filmmakers, seminars, music and dance. I spoke to Estrella Sandra, this year's festival director, asking her about the tricky balance of a festival that likes to appeal to both the curious and the academic. After all, it opens with a photography seminar and ends with a street dance film. But I began by asking if she thought this year's festival was the most ambitious yet.
I'd say that the effort this year was really in trying to create a balanced program that would also bring on board many discussions, because I think that, yes, we are speaking about cinema, but it's also a means of going through new lens in terms of what happens when we look at Africa, when it's through African art made by African artists or people who have been reflecting on this for a long time. So I think that that is also something that I wanted to point out, as well as all the members of the advisory board that were behind.
How do you balance choices between history and more forward-thinking films? Because there must be an audience out there for both.
So I think that it's important to create this balance of things that are maybe about oppression, like the one we have about the Western Sahara situation, or the one comparing the situation in Palestine with what happened in the apartheid in South Africa. But we also wanted to highlight the vibrant culture that is happening in many, many countries of the continent. So we have films that are focusing on music, films that are focusing on dance. We decided to open with Timbuktu, that was recently in Cannes and is the first film by Abderrahmane Sissako, which is in the official competition of Cannes. And he's one of the leading lights of African cinema. So I'm very, very proud to have managed to put this film as the opening film of the festival.
Other than as many as possible, what general audience are you aiming for? Because you have workshops in popular song, and you have music and dance, mm-hmm. and food that throws the doors open to everybody and come in and experience this. But some of the seminars, some of the workshops, some of the Q&As after the films are very academic.
Yes, indeed. And actually not two different ones. And that's also the reason why there are different venues. So as you said, there are seminars, parallel activities that are taking place. So one of them that is actually the first activity of the festival is the photo exhibition and seminar. And this is a seminar about a Spanish artist who is called Javier Hirschfeld, who tries to speak about cultural influences. So he takes the art of a Spanish painter and takes that to an extreme and brings it to Senegal, because that Spanish painter was focusing on the darkest women, and that's like the most astounding beauty and all of that. So in that case, we decided to organize that in the Fitzwilliam Museum, so that we also get a lot of people who are involved in arts, people who would like to go to museums, so just general audiences that are into art, because this festival is about art. But we also have, as you said, a workshop about South African popular song that is taking place in the Faculty of Education, and that is trying to show whoever likes to sing that you don't have to be necessarily South African or African to be attending this workshop, but if you like to sing, it would be a good chance to know about it.
You stressed a little bit earlier showing African filmmakers, African art that isn't Africa seen through Western eyes.
Mm-hmm.
How tricky is that, where many of the documentaries are still European filmmakers looking at Africa, and when examples of more populist African films, rather, you finish with Hear Me Move, which is vibrant and full of dance, but is still a sort of a type of film templated by Hollywood.
I don't think that is a disadvantage. I mean, to me, I think that these cross-cultural encounters can be seen as an opportunity. So we do have some films that are made by Western eyes somehow, but not really, because all of them have, in a way, African heritage, or have many Africans who are involved in the production. Like we have, for example, this fiction film that is called Die Welt, that is a Tunisian film about a young guy who is in Tunisia, and he kind of feels lost. He doesn't feel that the city is living in a moment that can offer a lot to citizens and so on. And actually, when you look at the film, you realize that there are so many experiences that were lived apparently as well by the filmmaker, because his father is from Tunisia, his mother is that. And again, that is something that brings a little bit of an identity dilemma. So all of them are talking to, I think, both communities. And the thing is, where is the meeting point over there, and what are the opportunities where we can mix, where we can also create co-productions and things like that? Because sometimes when looking at everyday Africa, and when looking at the cultural scene in Africa, we can learn so much, not just about them through their eyes, but also about ourselves.
Europa, ja, die Welt, ken ik. Maar Europa is niet meer als vroeger. No, Rob is finished, sorry.
I've mentioned in previous interviews for previous African film festivals that there hasn't been very much from a groundswell of new African filmmakers. Mm-hmm. That seems to be less the case with this year's festival, not only with Diwali, which you've just mentioned, but with the short films that are screening and mm-hmm. with the talk that follows the short films. I'm particularly interested, you've got somebody from the Slum Film Festival.
Yes,
and it, that sounds like that's much more reaching in and finding new voices from all that mm-hmm. wouldn't be heard at all, even mm-hmm. normally at a film festival.
Yes, that's an opportunity that came up with the Humanitarian Center. They wanted to celebrate something as the launch for the human rights celebration that they are having this year. And when speaking about it, then I decided to change the short film section that there used to be in the past in the festival to a panel discussion that would start with a short film that is kind of like the result of each of these initiatives, each of these projects, and then a short intervention by some of the protagonists of these projects, some of the people behind these projects. So it's basically, it's called Visions to be Heard, Empowering Young Africans to Film. So it's basically a panel that is presenting different projects that have to do with giving equipment to young Africans so they can create their own films. And as you mentioned, we have someone coming who was who is the organizer of the Slum Film Festival, along with Federico Olivieri. His name is Joshua McNamara. And because he's in SOAS in London at the moment, it's been really easy to get hold of him. So he will be showing one of the short films that was produced there in the context of the slums in Kenya throughout the festival date. And as well as this, we have other kind of projects that are showing other different kind of films that are really challenging to the ideas that people usually have about Africa.
How big is the pool of talent and films that a festival like this has to gather material from?
Here we are covering around 14 different countries because we have this important focus on South African film this year. But there is much more happening, and it's about little by little trying to bring it on board. There's a very important as well wave of cinema in North Africa, like in Algeria, in Tunisia. So if I may say so, after the festival, there will be things still happening. So I don't want to anticipate much, but at least the South African season is still going to be happening until February.
2 years ago, there were no South African films in that particular program. Mm-hmm. But this year, you have a partnership with South Africa at 20, this Freedom Tour, which you've mentioned in passing. Could you go a little bit more into detail about the variety of films that's bringing to Cambridge and the partnership that's allowing them?
So this is a very interesting question because it's the first time that it's happening. So it's brand new. And it's called South Africa at 20, the Freedom Tour. It is made by a consortium of African film festivals, so African Motion, that it's in Scotland, Film Africa in London, Africa Eye in Bristol, Watch Africa in Wales, and the Cambridge African Film Festival here. So what we have done is that we have created together a number of titles that to us are representative of what is happening right now in South Africa and what has happened in the past as well, but all of them under the umbrella of the celebration of the 20th anniversary of democracy in South Africa. There have been many events in the UK celebrating the 20th anniversary of South Africa, so obviously we wanted to be part of this event, and again, thanks to the funding of the BFI as well as the South African Departments of Arts and Culture and the British Council, we have been able to put together a really good program. And we have structured the titles around three different themes. So one of them is Freedom Struggles, the other one is Post-Apartheid Challenges, and the other one is Young South African Voices. And that's why we get to see that variety. So for example, we are screening here in Cambridge, Hear Me Move, that is part of the Young South African Voices. But we are also screening Miners Shot Down and Four Corners, that is part of the Post-Apartheid Challenges, and 1994, The Bloody Miracle, that is part of the Freedom Struggles, that is about what happened in the first elections in South Africa.
And on Saturday, you've also got Princess of Africa showing. Could you explain a little bit about that, please?
As part of our pre-closing party event, we are starting with another documentary as well that is absolutely beautiful. It's a documentary that draws the attention to the influence of, let's say, Spanish and Senegalese art. So it's very linked to the idea of the exhibition that is going to be for the whole festival in the Arts Picture House. And it's about the story about a Senegalese griot who marries a Spanish dancer. And again, a story about dreams, what she's expecting of Senegal, what the daughter of him is expecting of Spain, and how all those dreams are really kind of connected and not met. So while speaking about art, music with beautiful watercolors throughout the whole documentary, we also have a very interesting topic going on.
Assalamualaikum. Man la Mariam Ndiaye. Setatu Talabakar Kodou Ndiaye. Domu Papa Ndiaye. Setu Dembe Dieye Ndiaye. Geul bu mak te siw te Louga. Man fecci kat la. Guardare mi sueño.
When you put the word Africa, there are so many pre-assumptions, there are so many ideas, so that is already a challenge. It is quite tricky because you get different reactions. So people who are really keen to see African films and some other people who are going to think, no, if it's African, it can't be serious. So this is going to say, hey, it is, look at this and look what has been made. And I think that for some of them, it's going to be quite an enlightening experience.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Estrella for finding time for the interview and to Jack Toy from the Arts Picture House for putting the two of us in contact. As I already mentioned, the Cambridge African Film Festival runs from November the 1st, so next Saturday, to the 9th. Most weekday screenings are in the early afternoon and tickets are already on sale from the Arts Picture House. And remember that many of the documentaries are free to go to. You can find out more at www.cambridgeafricanfilmfestival.org.uk.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You are indeed listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 with me, Toby Miller, and in the studio are Emma Marchant, Yossi Osman and Simon West. A quick rundown what follows us from 1pm straight after we vacate the studio is Life and Art, the new monthly look at the art circuit on Cambridge. They've got something on the Wisling Arts Centre's current exhibition Influence of Furniture on Love, and which I've been trying to get to, and looks ahead to the Winter Cambridge Literary Festival and a production of 1984 at the Arts Theatre. At 2pm, 105 swaps art for business with In Your Company, followed by The Science Show at 2:30 and Hispanic Voices at 3pm. Then 105 Sport wraps up the afternoon from 4pm, offering all the latest national and local sporting results. We've still got an unbelievably crowded, 24 minutes of Bums on Seats, including a review of Fury. But first, we must rise for the next review.
All right. Is there anything either council care to add?
My mom passed away this morning.
Is this the first time your mother passed away, or is this something you do on all the cases you're about to lose?
First time.
Biggest mistake of your career and you just happened to run him over?
Forensics found traces of blood on your dad's car.
I sat on the bench in that courtroom for 42 years.
This was an accident, period.
We need to establish a firm defense.
There's no we here, Henry.
I wish I liked you more.
I can't stay.
You're a lawyer, he is your father.
You leave now, you will regret it.
You're a shined up wooden nickel, Mr. Palmer. I'm going to impale your client on a first degree murder charge, and you get a front row seat.
My father's a lot of unpleasant things, and murder is not one of them.
Occasionally, respectability can dull an actor's edge. Former enfant terrible Robert Downey Jr. now balances his career between being Iron Man and taking on heavyweight dramatic roles at smack of award bait. Where once he excelled in playing losers, he now seems to prefer losers who learn a lesson. New release, The Judge, looks seems to offer more of the same. Directed by David Dobkin, the film casts Downey Jr. as a hotshot defence attorney named Hank Palmer, an unbeatable courtroom champ with the arrogant swagger to drive the point home. When his mother suddenly passes away, Hank has to venture back to his Bible Belt hometown for the first time in decades, in the process coming face to face with his estranged father. Played by the always formidable Robert Duvall, Joseph Palmer is a fire and brimstone county judge with 42 years behind the bench and little patience for fools. Hank hopes to say his farewells in Scarper, but when his father is incriminated in a fatal hit and run, Hank may be the one person who can save him from prison. You'll see, the judge seems almost a perfect showpiece for Robert Downey Jr. There's lots of showy courtroom scenes and lots of family angst, equally showy family angst. But is it a film that is anything more than an actor's masterclass for both he and Duvall?
Well, I mean, look, this film screams Oscar bait. It's a courtroom drama. It's got, you know, family problems. And if you look at that cast, you've got Robert Downey Jr., Robert Duvall, Billy Bob Thornton, Vera Farmiga. It's a very good cast. So I was expecting it to be very showy in the first place. I'll come out and say that I didn't really like The Judge because I was disappointed. You had a really good cast. The story seemed all right. But at the end of the day, I just didn't feel that there was a lot of substance there. I thought it was quite dull. I thought it could have done with being about half an hour shorter. And it was very cliche ridden. There were so many cliches in the courtroom scenes and with the kind of family problems. And for me, I was very frustrated because I felt like it could have been so much better than it was. And when you've got such a good cast like that, it's just such a shame, really. Yeah.
Simon, you feel differently.
I mean, I went into the film. It's actually produced by Robert Downey Jr. and his wife, production company.
I think they produce pretty much everything he's in.
They produce a lot of that he's in, but it did seem to be a case of this is me wanting to win an Oscar as I went in. And you could get a nomination for it, possibly. I thought it was a really good film. The performances, like I said, it is an actor's masterclass, and I don't know why you wouldn't want to see an actor's masterclass. Robert Downey Jr. is fantastic. Robert Duvall is brilliant. Special shout out to Vincent D'Onofrio, who's probably one of the most interesting and I think Toby thinks they're sideline characters, as his brother, who's just put upon. And I found this film wasn't cliched. Every time you think it's going to be, from the trailer, what you thought it's going to be, like a big courtroom drama, it isn't. And it is more family based, but you know, you get sides. Every time you think, oh, this is what a normal film will do, it doesn't. I thought it went in a slightly different direction, or it handled it differently, or things mentioned in a film, I think, about his younger brother, for example. One of the best things I thought was a scene in a hospital where Vincent D'Onofrio saying, you're in a city, you don't know what's happening here, I've got to deal with all the fallout. And you expect it to be a big thing, and it's kind of left at that, and I liked that.
That's true, yes.
It's not part of the story. It adds the depth, it adds the colour, it adds the flavour to it. It is an interesting story, how you have the defendant not wanting to be defended because of personal history, and if they weren't related, it still would have been an interesting case. And the fact it wasn't just, family drama getting in the way of the court cases. It's a whole characters are based on it and their legacy and everything. And I really couldn't see anything wrong with it. I mean, yeah, there are going to be better films out there. There are going to be stronger films out there. But I absolutely enjoyed it. And I thought the acting in it was absolutely magnificent.
Did it just need to back off from the hubris a little bit? Because everything you just said, I didn't think of. And you're quite right. But at the same time, I just felt it was this usual. And I like Robert Downey Jr. And though he's playing Tony Stark in this again. His intonation is the same. Having just watched The Avengers again a couple of weeks ago, he says some of the same lines exactly the same way. I wish he'd go back playing interesting characters like he did in The Wonder Boys and films like that. Anyway, don't get sidetracked again, Toby. But at the same time, there is too much hubris and there's too much fake melodrama. He is a hotshot lawyer who still... He's breaking into a bar in one scene. It turns out it's okay. He doesn't know it's okay when he's breaking in. He's taking his 11-year-old daughter illegally driving. He was on the money legally a minute ago. If he's caught doing either of these two things, he's out of town and the whole film falls apart. It changes his character to where the cliche needs it to be. If it had just backed off all of that Oscar nonsense and just been a straight drama with two excellent actors and a fantastic supporting cast, it would have been fine. But it's just everything, and we'll come to it with Fury, everything has to be turned up to 11.
And that's the thing. They're just trying to hit you with all this sentimentality throughout the film, with all these different storylines as well. And this is one of my big problems with the film, is that you've got several little subplots to the kind of story with Robert Downey Jr. and Robert Duvall. It's the father-son relationship. You've also got the thing about his high school girlfriend. There's that little story there. And then you've got the story with his brothers, which I think, because I agree with you, I really liked the relationship between the brothers, but I felt that wasn't developed enough. You've also got that weird little incest story going on.
That is peculiar, isn't it? And tonally, it's interesting, but it doesn't do enough with it. It just remains a bad taste.
But I thought that's a nice kind of twist. You don't normally get that kind of story in a straightforward
film. It is, but it doesn't twist it far enough.
You know, a few complaints about it being tonally indifferent, because it does have this kind of occasional comedic thread and through it, which some people complain, but I quite liked it, because it meant things weren't heavy all the time. It meant it did go places you wouldn't expect a normal Hollywood drama of this to be. You would expect this to be like a John Grisham straight if anything, and I like the fact it wasn't.
And I do agree with you on that. I just felt that some of those little stories, you know, especially, you know, the one with the incest, were not developed enough. They were kind of just there and left there. I mean, it was just, it was all a bit strange.
They were there to give character. I mean, like I said, I think it would agree, you know, a few of them could have been cut out, especially, for example, his daughter, except it's relating his parenting to the parenting he received and things like that, and you've got compare and contrast. But like the fact these little stories, they weren't always fully resolved. You don't always find everything, but they all applied a little bit of character.
I think it's because they're more interesting than the story the film is giving us. Robert Downey Jr.'s character is... he's the usual arrogant so-and-so who has his redemptive arc that you need to have if you have any chance of winning an Oscar. You can't remain a dirty, thieving lawyer. You've got to come clean in somehow or other. His brother, which you've mentioned, his brother's a far more interesting character. The film doesn't have to be about him, but everything gets blown away every time that Downey Jr. comes on screen, that Hank comes on screen, and the film just stops and says, look who we've got in our film. And I just felt that unbalanced the good parts that I think that I wasn't aware of, but you're quite right, were there. I just I needed to stop trying to please everybody.
Yeah. It was Oscar bait. I don't deny this,
which is not a term I like, because it tends to be levelled at anything that isn't a superhero film now and isn't an indie drama. Films fall into three categories: blockbuster, indie drama, Oscar bait. You know, rubbish.
It's more because of the type of film it is and everything else. You know, he's the highest paid actor. Everybody loves him at the moment, but he don't think he's had the reward. And the fact he produced it, you know,
it's just a shame, really.
He's a shame, but no, he has shown he is a really good actor.
He's good in it. He's very good.
I hope. I don't know if actors demand Oscars in the way critics think they're after Oscars. I'm not quite sure. I think critics have much more of a hang-up about that than actors do, which is another reason why Oscar bait is a term invented by critics rather than actors.
Sure. Anyway, sorry.
No. Yeah, I'm just going to keep cutting you off. That's what I'm doing. That's why I'm here. Okay, The Judge opened last weekend in a screening at all three Cambridge cinemas. It is a certificate 15.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Now, we don't nearly cover enough avant-garde cinema on Bums on Seat, despite the esoteric screenings that are put on by Cambridge stalwarts such as Aid and Abet and Bad Timing. But later this week, on October the 29th, to be precise, there's a chance to see two experimental movies screened during last month's Cambridge Film Festival: Lucy Harris's short Crossing Point and The View from Our House, directed by Anthea Kennedy and Ian Wilbon. The film screened earlier this year at the Cambridge Film Festival, as I just mentioned. They're about how memory is triggered by architecture. Crossing Point is based on footage shot at the Berlin Olympic Stadium in 1936, whilst View from Our House mixes 8mm video and voiceover to investigate the memories of a photographer whose work captured the rise of Nazi Germany. After the festival screenings, local artist Hannah Clarkson spoke to all three directors about their work. She began by asking Lucy Harris about the use of rhythm in the editing of Crossing Point.
You could say, and when you pass by here, you hear screaming. Or when you pass by this building, which you cannot see because of the high wall. You hear screaming.
One of the things that was very important in the film is that there's actually a rhythm that's almost like a rolling rhythm that mirrors the idea that history isn't a sort of linear from A to B, that there's a space for pauses and there's a space for returning and touching the past and how that informs where we are now. And also that the rhythm is used as a disorientating device for the viewer, so that there are very clearly framed spaces that are very defined, like the lines of the track or how the seating is presented, that is almost like a very graphic image. And then actually something like the sequence where the lift takes you down, I think the intention was for the viewer that actually it's like you're moved through that space. So I think it's about trying to create a narrative that works physically as well as something that is about history, that it is something that you as the audience have to actually sort of give way to, in a sense.
I think rhythm in film, actually, for me, it's kind of almost, well, I wouldn't say the most important, but in terms of editing, I think it's the most, well, and shooting, it's the most important aspect of filmmaking. You sort of do it by feel, you know, what the right length of a shot are. Plus the sort of the repetitions and the way these things repeat, which are kind of meant in a sort of musical way rather than a boring way, hopefully, you know. Endlessly repeating information.
When we were filming, it's a response to the spaces that you're in, and I think you are affected by the weather and the sounds you hear around you and the whole environment. So, you know, there is a kind of, in a sense, the shots you come up with kind of reflect that. I mean, I'm also a photographer. I mean, but I mean, you know, we shot the film together, but there's some kind of way that the stillness of it relates to still photography, and also the film's about a photographer as well. So that the relationship of time in photography is kind of part of it as well.
And again, with this idea of voice, I suppose both films are really attempts to give voice to a place as well. I wonder whether you could talk about that a little bit more.
Well, I suppose in our film, the locations that we're filming are actually quite ordinary. You know, they're not memorable spaces like the Olympic Stadium. It's a sort of everyday, ordinary street. I mean, it's a kind of particular place because it is this estate that was based on a garden suburb. So, and even the prison building itself is, you know, it's quite an ordinary building, and certainly from the outside, it doesn't suggest the history that it holds. And I suppose we just tried to, through the way that we put those images together, and through this sense of spending time with, or at the building, at the site of where this memory occurred, to kind of give voice to the history of the place. Yeah. And I think in the way, maybe Anthony can say more as well, but through the editing, the way, if you like, the deadness of the place is transcended is through the movement that actually does occur in the shots, even if it's just the movement of a bush or, you know, just some detail like that. So that combination of stillness and movement is also part of trying to create a sense of the place.
Or when you pass by here on your way to the station, you hear screaming.
You are really looking, you know, you are really looking and you are really noticing. And I think, you know, in terms of that idea of stillness as well and the still photographer, that there's something about that space that is really about trying to really notice all these things that we just go past every day. And I think to look in that way also means that you have to sort of be looking inside as well.
I'm only just 18, but sometimes I already feel so old that I think of dying.
away from your radio. Listen to Cambridge 105 online through your computer or smartphone. Go to cambridge105.fm and click Listen Now.
Many thanks to Hannah Clarkson and to Lucy Harris and Anthea Kennedy and Ian Wilburn. The screening of these two rather brilliant films is this coming Wednesday at 6 p.m. at Anglia Ruskin University, and it's a free event. In his career as first a screenwriter and then a writer-director, David Ayer has been fascinated with the fraternal bonds of Men in Arms, The Policeman in End of Watch, Denzel Washington, Ethan Hawke and Training Day, and the top Trump schoolboy antics of the first Fast and Furious film, which he wrote. Ayer's new film, Fury, continues his theme, though now the drama unfolds in the theatre of war. Set in the last few months of World War II, Fury stars Brad Pitt as Sergeant War Daddy Collier, gruff commander of an American Sherman tank, the Fury of the title, part of the advancing line into Germany. His three-man crew are as battle-hardened as their beloved leader. None take kindly to a fresh new recruit in Private Ellison, played by Logan Lerman, who replaces a killed colleague. The meek and moral Ellison is trained as an army clerk and has little idea of the horrors that await as Fury rumbles towards Berlin.
I started this war killing Germans in Africa. Now I'm killing Germans in Germany. Been with these fine gentlemen for years.
These troops get by you.
We're all dead in the water.
All we got is you.
I won't ask you to do anything I haven't done myself.
Comm check.
Photo check.
Brady check.
Bob check.
Bob check.
Do your job! Know what you're here for!
They're coming!
How many?
300 of them. There's five against 300.
We ain't never run before. Why are we gonna run now?
We're still in this fight!
Simon, wake up. Modern war films, especially from Hollywood, are always looking for a balance between depicting war red in tooth and claw, but also being an action film that pleases the audience or gives the audience a thrill. Does Fury find that balance? We have 4 minutes.
I don't know. Certainly a good action film. There were two sides to Fury. One was, I can't deny, I don't think many people can deny, it looks amazing. It is absolutely beautiful cinematography. The action scenes are really well choreographed. It's actually an interesting take to see tank warfare, so it adds one of those.
Yes, it's well shot as well.
You know, technically, is absolutely fantastic. However, that's not necessarily a recommendation to see it, because I think the actual story and characters are absolutely morally repellent in this film.
But isn't the film trying to? It may not be successful saying war makes people morally repellent.
And we know that already. We've seen that Platoon. But here, it portrays them as heroes. It's saying it's a good thing. You get the hell yeah moment in this film is when the young innocent guy finally loses almost like the last of his humanity. The men are there just purely to be killed, and the women are there to be their reward, sexual rewards, once they free them. It's absolutely awful. It's gone and taken the modern gore, which you kind of see in films like Walking Dead and, well, not films, you know, TV shows, and it's getting more and more common, and just applying them to the German soldiers. You've had so many war films actually investigating both sides, and, you know, that the fact that there are men, there are humans. You've got Private Ryan and, you know, even the pianist, you've got even Downfall, you know, trying to portray Hitler as a human being. But this one, it is just Germans are there to be killed, and it's good to be a killing machine with no emotion.
It's worse than that, Cecilia. It's actually, come to you, I'm on this. The film is trying to have its cake and eating it, surely, in that it sets up with a card at the very first that Hitler has declared total war, that anybody of who can fire a gun is conscripted to defend Germany. Yeah. And we have child soldiers and everybody looking horrified at the beginning, look at what we're having to kill now. And then at the end, for our big battle where we have to hurrah, the SS, like zombie warriors with their own theme tune, just march over the hill. It takes them a long time to march over the hill.
Okay. I disagree with Simon. I do agree with you to a certain extent. And then my one problem probably with this film is that last set piece scene. It kind of goes away from reality there, I think, into a kind of a place of, it felt like it needed some kind of big ending, and maybe that doesn't sit so well with the rest of the film. But I think the rest of the film, like you say, it looks incredible. I really want to point out Shia LaBeouf, because I don't really know much about Transformers. Shia LaBeouf, I just kind of look and, you know, he seems to... But he was excellent. Brad Pitt is really good. Logan Lerman does a good job of being our kind of innocent cypher. I thought that there's a set piece in the middle, which Simon had obviously massive problems with about the whole section. I didn't see it that way at all when they've taken over the village or whatever. And there is... It's an interesting scene, and it's a really interesting scene. I kind of applaud this film for going there, because it's an incredibly tense scene where they do go into this house and there is a woman and her cousin there, and for a while it feels like they're almost playing house, and then the reality comes back and hits you square in the face. And I think that's a really important thing to say. This comes from David Ayres, who's done very, very contemporary films set in South Central LA, which I believe is where he's from. He has kind of transported that into this tank here, and I think things that make the Second World War, maybe it's going to appeal to a kind of younger audience, that's really important. It makes it feel relevant. I didn't go in expecting to love it. I actually came out saying, you know what, I think that was a really, really good film, and I think it said some stuff and looked great while it was doing
that
it.
That middle section is like more of a mini home invasion film where you're actually cheering on the bad guys.
No, you're not cheering on the bad guys. It's almost like a one-act play in the middle. I don't think, no. And I think it's interesting that actually it is not a gung-ho, whoop-whoop, aren't the Americans great? Which, for example, I was talking to someone, they were like, oh, God, those films of the Americans just coming in and saving at the end of the war. It's not like that at all. And there is a really interesting shot at the end, which I thought that said something. And you can't deny that the SS were really the bad guys. I mean, they were worse than the Americans at the end of the day, but there isn't a sign.
But they are set up as a convenient villain suddenly. I mean, they
it's a Second World War film, what do you expect?
I know, but the whole platoon of them, Logan Lerman comes over and says it's an SS platoon, and they're singing their little SS song, and it's just
you see earlier on there's one SS guy, and yeah, we know they're the bad guys, but suddenly it's like, and here's 100 for us to kill without feeling.
All right, okay, we have to wrap up, or we'll be cut off by the news. Fury opened yesterday, October the 24th, and is screening at both Cambridge Multiplex Cinemas. It is a Certificate 15. We'll be back in a fortnight's time. This podcast will be released in a couple of days. We'll be back on November the 8th with Interstellar, Leviathan, Nightcrawler, and Mr. Turner, and some other stuff, I'm sure, some other films. Please stay tuned for Life and Art. But from everybody on Bums on Seats, goodbye.
Goodbye.